From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, actor Viggo Mortensen talks about his new movie, Green Book, a true story about friendship and the limitations of first impressions.
It's a movie about dignity, acceptance, and above all, compassion. Compassion is a composite word that means feeling with.
And Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave, has made a heist movie called Widows. It's set in Chicago and anchored by Viola Davis.
It was very important for me to have an upper-middle-class leading black woman who is of the city but has done well, because I see those women and they're never represented.
All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, a tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman as Queen Anne and Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz as the women of the court vying for her favor, in select theaters Friday.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Netflix, presenting an original film from Academy Awards-winning directors Joel and Ethan Coen, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, an exploration of life's joys and woes set in the American frontier. Awards eligible on Netflix and in select theaters.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. In 1962, Frank Vallelonga, better known as Tony Lip, was a rough around the edges Italian-American bouncer working at the Copacabana nightclub in New York City. Don Shirley was a black composer and piano virtuoso planning a tour of the Jim Crow era South. Shirley hired Lip as a driver and a bodyguard, and along the way, despite their many differences, the two became friends. The new movie Green Book, directed by Peter Farrelly and co-written by Tony's son, Nick Vallelonga, tells the story of their trip. The title refers to an actual guidebook for African-American travelers that listed safe places to eat and sleep during segregation. In the film, Viggo Mortensen plays Tony Lip and Mahershala Ali plays Don Shirley. Mortensen says that he was initially reluctant to take on the role. He was worried that his portrayal of Tony Lip might come across as a caricature. Once he found out that Tony's son Nick had recorded several interviews with his father and with Don Shirley before both men died in 2013, Mortensen knew that he'd have something to work with.
So I got a hold of Nick Vallelonga, the guy who brought this story to Pete and Tony's son. And he said, well, come over, let's go have a meal, you know, with my brother Frank. He's got a restaurant called Tony Lips in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey. And went there, and it was like, it ended up being like a 6-7 hour meal.
Of course it was.
Almost destroyed me, because I hadn't gained the weight yet. I hadn't expanded my stomach.
This is where the weight gain started, maybe.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it definitely did. But it was almost lethal, because I would get through the second huge plate, and then I was done, and I was thinking, man, I shouldn't have had breakfast. I shouldn't have had breakfast all week.
Another stromboli for Viggo.
Yeah, and they brought another plate, and then I couldn't get through it, and then they're looking, and they're going, ah, he doesn't like it. I told you, you overcooked it. I said, no, it's great. I got no more room. Nah, it's all right. Don't be shy. You don't like it. So I felt I had to finish the plate, but every time I finish it, they bring another one. Anyway, and then I said goodbye, but we shared. Fortunately, it was talk, not just eating. And they told me so many things, showed me so many photographs. Nick had already given me these recordings, and you know, then I said goodbye. We did a picture together. I limped to my rental car, and I made a big show of like, oh, I'm driving back to Manhattan. I drove around the corner, parked the car, leaned my seat back, undid my belt, and lay there for an hour just groaning. It was brutal. But the thing about, I mean, so it was, you know, I mean, I don't know how I would have done it without their help. They were very generous. These recordings are amazing. And, you know, when Nick's parents, his father as well as his mother Dolores, played by Linda Cardellini in the movie, when they realized he was serious, he wanted to tell this story, they said, well, the first thing you got to do is you got to go talk to Don Shirley. You got to make sure he's like, he's okay with this, first of all, and that you can check out whether this is true, everything I'm telling you. And if he doesn't want you to make this movie, you don't make this movie. And he goes, okay. So he goes over, and, you know, he talked to Shirley, and Shirley said, yes, these things happen, and I can tell you some more things that happened, but I only ask you one thing, don't make this movie until I'm gone.
Wow.
As you see in the movie, for good reasons, he was someone who...
That private.
He was a very private person, and they did respect that. So, I mean, Nick Vallelonga hung on to the story for, I think, 25 years. But sometimes things happen when they need to, you know. The fact that Pete Farrelly directed this with his particular gifts for storytelling was the right, absolute right thing. I mean, to me, what Pete Farrelly has accomplished is on a par with the best of Preston Sturges. Oh. Someone else who, at the time of his greatest successes that were popular as well as thought-provoking, there were critics at that time. They were like, yeah, you know, it's entertaining. It's a crowd pleaser. It's like, in other words, to say, well, just because something's entertaining, maybe it's not serious enough. But Preston Sturges was doing the same thing with Sullivan's Travels and other stories that Pete Farrelly does now with Green Book, which is, I'm going to get you in the theater. I'm going to entertain you. You're going to laugh. You're going to cry. And you're going to think about stuff that is serious, that needs to be addressed in society.
This is a film that's really about an unlikely friendship between Tony Lip and Don Shirley. But it's also about a love story. And it's a love story about Tony and his wife, Dolores, who's played by Linda Cardellini. I want to play you a scene from the movie about the letters that are written from the road from Tony, with a little bit of help from Don.
As I'm writing this letter, I'm eating potato chips, and I'm starting to get thirsty. And you know this is pathetic, right? Tell me what you're trying to say.
I don't know. Yeah, I'll miss her.
Then say that, but do it in a manner that no one else has ever done it before. Something like, put this down. Falling in love with you was the easiest thing I've ever done.
Nothing matters to me but you. And every day I'm alive, I'm aware of this. I loved you the day I met you. I love you today. And I will love you the rest of my life.
I believe these letters still exist, right? They're around.
Yeah. The other thing his Dolores, Nick's mom, did was one day she said, come here. She took him into the bedroom, and she opened one of the drawers in her dresser, and under some other stuff, there was a box with, I think there's almost 70 letters, 67, 68 letters from this trip with Don Shirley, and it's all the letters that he sent home to her. So that material we use, I mean, and that's just another, you're right, it's a love story between these two guys, but it's a love story between Tony and his wife, Dolores, and in a way, in a sort of Cyrano de Bergerac way, like living vicariously, loving vicariously, having this, appreciating this. Obviously, Tony really is crazy about his wife, and Doc could see this. And, he had a degree in psychology as well, and he is reputed to have said, and he said it to Nick, that, you know, your father was someone that it was a really interesting object of study for me during this trip. I had to teach him how to speak intelligibly, first of all. But then I think it became sort of initially a pastime for Doc to help him with these letters. But then it became something that he got involved in emotionally.
Coming up after the break, more of my conversation with Viggo Mortensen about his new movie, Green Book. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll get back now to my conversation with actor Viggo Mortensen about his new movie, Green Book. Mortensen plays Tony Lip, a nightclub bouncer who worked as a driver and bodyguard for jazz pianist Don Shirley, who's played in the film by Mahershala Ali. The two met when Shirley, along with a bassist and a cellist who made up the Don Shirley Trio, embarked on a tour of the American South in the early 1960s. When I spoke with Viggo Mortensen, I asked him about some of the reactions that he's heard from people who've seen the film.
You know, there's people that have said to me, you know, it's great it came out now. This is a good time because the country's divided ideologically. There's a lot of intentional, indirect, and sometimes very direct race baiting and, you know, homophobia and all kinds of stuff in the air. The adults, the people that should be behaving well, our leaders are not always leading by example lately. But I say, yeah, it is a good movie to come out at this time. It could, because it's entertaining, it can reach a lot of people. And it's not a movie, you wouldn't say, well, let's go see that movie. It's a movie about racism. You'd say, let's go see this movie. I hear it's funny and it's a great road movie and it's a true buddy story. And then you go see it, and whether you're from a small town in Texas or you're from California, New York, it doesn't matter where you see it in the country and what the political leanings of your household might be, you're gonna get a history lesson and a civics lesson. You're going to have something to think about, but it's not in your face.
I think a lot of people don't even know what a green book is, and I have a personal story.
I see you have a copy of the 1940 version.
I have a copy of the 1940 version, but I have a story. My father was a sports writer, and he was working at Sports Illustrated in the 1960s, right about the time that this movie was set, and he was on assignment in Florida, and he was traveling with a young boxer named Cassius Clay, and they got to Miami. And they went to the hotels, and my father went to his hotel, and Cassius Clay couldn't come into that hotel because he was an African-American in the 1960s. Mm. And he got his green book, Cassius Clay got his green book, and found the hotel where a black man could stay in the 1960s. So this is a story that I know. I mean, this is a story that not a lot of people know, but that if you were an African-American, not just traveling in the South, I mean, there are listings in this book.
In the North, too.
In the North. This is
even in Canada in some places, frankly.
And your story is set before the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is passed. Brown versus Board of Education has come out, but the nation is not desegregated at all. And there are certain cities where African Americans cannot go after curfew, after the sun goes down.
Towns. Yeah, and there's a scene that deals with that. I mean, we're thrown in jail for that. In fact, we're driving through a township in Mississippi. One night, and they stop us, and, you know, it's because I'm driving, and there's a black man in the car. Herschel Ely is in the car, and Doc Shirley, and we're thrown in jail because of that. Nothing else. I mean, those were laws that were on the books. It's true. There was, there's a motel. You remember the scene where I drop him off? It's meant to be Louisville in the thing, and it's the first time where we don't get to stay in the same place, I believe. And we were shooting this scene. It's a motel. There's an overpass. It's down in the edge of, you know, on the edges of New Orleans, of the city of New Orleans. And we were shooting, and there was a man there, an older black man, probably in his 70s. He started telling Pete Fairley, as they were setting up the lights and stuff in the camera, he goes, "Yeah, this is where the Motown people stay, and this is where, you know, Ray Charles and all the Motown singers, all those people and male and female artists that would come down, and they would play in the best venues in downtown New Orleans, but they could not stay at any of the many, you know, hotels in downtown New Orleans. They had to stay in this motel. This was a Green Book motel, and we had no idea, and we were filming there and dressed it to look that way, but it was that way. And then Pete said, "Can you act?" And he goes, "I don't know." And so he's the guy who, you know, when they're asking Doc Shirley to play horseshoes?
Yeah, he's the guy out pitching shoes.
He's the guy who they're trying to get him to play. He goes, "I can't, my shoulder."
Oh, he's sitting on the chair.
You know, that guy. And it's that guy who told us the story. It was fascinating. He told us all these artists that had stayed there, like really big deal, superstars.
We're talking with Viggo Mortensen about his new movie, Green Book. What did Don Shirley see as his mission, as his calling? What was the story that he was telling about himself and about people who look like him through music? Why did he go there?
I think that he did that tour down south where he wasn't treated as well as he would have been up north or in other places. I mean, he couldn't stay in the hotels. He couldn't eat in the venues where he was playing. He couldn't use the bathroom. You know, I mean, it was just ridiculous. But he knew he was going to get into that, and he wouldn't get a dressing room. He'd have to change basically a broom closet in some cases, would be paid very little and not treated well. He went to do that for the same reason I would say that Martin Luther King marched, you know, with other people, because we can, because we are citizens of this country, and it's a public road, and I can walk down any road I want. I can walk through any town. I can cross any bridge, and it's a form of nonviolent protest. So here's a man who could speak, I don't know, 8 languages or something. He had 3 doctorates. He was, as you see in the movie, you know, played excellently by Mahershala Ali. He's a gentleman, a wise person, and he just figured, I'll go down there where white people think that, you know, many of them think that black people are subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
And how could a guy be wearing a suit? How could a guy play the piano like that? How could he play Chopin like that? How could he speak that way? How could he have better manners than they have, better education than they have? Just by example, not being forceful, just by showing up.
What do you think Tony takes away from his friendship with Don? How has he changed by this experience?
He evolves. It's evident when he returns home. It's evident to his wife and the rest of his family. And Nick has told me that he came back a changed man to some degree. He was still himself, like, you know, speaking without censoring himself and, you know, bluster and, you know, just the way he always had been. But in terms of how to treat others, you know, particularly those who were, you know, different race, from then on he toned down his language and, most importantly, his attitude. We all know that language can evolve, can change, but just because you don't use offensive language and words, you can still have racist inclinations and thoughts and feelings. But his attitude changed, and his example changed the way the family looked at race to some degree. There was an evolution. He learned from, but they both learn. I think that,
right,
Doug Shirley
definitely
opens his mind. To some degree, it's a movie about the limitations of first impressions.
Well, and this is where I think this film is its most contemporary. Don and Tony had very little in common. They had completely different educations, completely different interests. Their tastes in music, food, everything was radically different. They had different skin color. They came from totally different paths. They were others to each other. And yet they saw in each other something that was shared. And they took away from that experience something that they wanted to bring into the world. And that feels like where this film is most relevant today, mm-hmm. that we can't engage with people who are other than us or listen to them or see how they see the world.
Or we're not encouraged to, certainly by those who should do the most encouraging,
exactly,
from the president on down.
Right.
I mean, it's, in a sense, it's a movie about dignity, acceptance, and above all, compassion. Compassion is a composite word. It's made of two words. It means feeling with. If you feel with someone, that means you're paying attention. You're considering how they might feel about something, anything. And that's already a step toward realizing that you are not really that different, that we all have similar needs, similar fears. You know, fear of getting ill, of dying, of being hurt, of being hungry, companionship. You know, companionship is something that is one of the many things that in the end, as irritating as Tony Lip is to Doc Shirley at first, he would never go on a road trip with a guy like this. You know, he's used to having drivers who never speak unless they're spoken to, I'm sure, and certainly don't eat and smoke in the car and play whatever music they want on the radio. They just don't. They just drive, and they get there on time, and they keep their mouth shut. And then he's got this, what he sees at first as a loudmouth, oaf, ignorant, offensive person. But he learns to appreciate the companionship of this person. He learns that this person, who seems like a brute, actually has a certain code of ethics, is a man of his word, and most importantly, is capable of evolution. And so that's what brings them together gradually in a very organic way. It's a beautiful story in that sense.
Viggo Mortensen plays opposite Mahershala Ali in Green Book. It's in theaters now. Viggo, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for the conversation.
Green Book is in theaters now. Coming up, how a short-lived British show from the 1980s led to director Steve McQueen's follow-up to 12 Years a Slave.
K
KVCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, a royal tale of loyalty, power, and deception from director Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Olivia Colman, Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, Nicholas Holt, Joe Alwyn, and Mark Gatiss in select theaters Friday.
KPCC podcasts are supported by the Netflix original film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. From the incomparable minds of Joel and Ethan Coen comes a six-part anthology film, original stories that only they could tell. Set against the harsh and unforgiving backdrop of the American frontier, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is an exploration of life's joys and woes. Winner of the Best Screenplay at the Venice Film Festival, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, on Netflix and now playing in select theaters.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. My next guest is British filmmaker and visual artist Steve McQueen. His last film, 12 Years a Slave, won the Best Picture Oscar in 2013. When he was in L.A. recently, we met up to talk about his new movie, Widows. In the film, Viola Davis and Michelle Rodriguez are among a group of women whose husbands are killed trying to pull off a heist. The women not only have lost their partners, but also any chance to make ends meet and ward off the man that their husbands stole from. So they decide to stage a robbery of their own. McQueen co-wrote the screenplay with Gillian Flynn, the author of the novel Gone Girl, and the movie is based on a British TV show called Widows that first ran in 1983.
I saw this TV show when I was 13 years old, Widows. I saw it was originally a TV show written by Linda LaPlante, and it really got to me.
Now's your chance.
We'll get Rawlins.
Dolly Rawlins and Bella O'Reilly have a plan to make sure that Harry is caught this time.
What about you?
I'll be there.
And that Shirley is safe.
You make sure you get the police there.
But will he get away again? If he does, the Widows are in bad trouble.
You know, I related to the women in that TV show. You know, the fact that, you know, they were being judged by their parents and they were deemed as not being capable. So immediately I had this connection with them and I just loved that the adventure they went on, surfing, navigating the whole idea of these stereotypes which were put upon them. And it was thrilling to see. So it was that. And I just wanted to keep the nucleus of these women becoming widows through their men attempting to do this heist and that they had to, because of duress, attempt to do a heist in order to survive.
And why they've actually chosen these men and stayed with them is also a big question, isn't it?
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Oh, well, as well, how they meet. I mean, again, there's like Harry and Veronica meet. She's definitely from a higher class than him, and he's from a lower class, you know, so there's opposites attract. And it's a situation where, you know, you see these kind of relationships all the time, every day. You know, they exist. They're not the stereotypical couple, but that's not what I'm interested in.
What were you interested in?
A certain kind of reality. So my existence. You know, I love the idea of when Veronica says, for example, to one of the widows, when the widows ask her, how did you and Harry meet? She goes, follow me. She just brushes to one side because it's this idea of what people have in their heads of who could be with who. And that's just not the truth. There's a certain situation where stereotypes are given to us because they're easily palated, easy for us to digest. But on reality, there's so much complication in our everyday.
And it's not just a black woman with a white guy. It's that they come out of different backgrounds and different
for
educational
sure.
backgrounds,
I mean,
strata of society.
I know those women who come from Chicago who are upper middle class women. One of them, for example, and who come from a certain class and who sort of end up in a certain situation because of education. Are they all around us? I mean, one of them is your former first lady, Michelle Obama. I mean, this is how it is. Valerie Jarrett, women who are mobile and active. I mean, in any and every kind of background or society, yes.
This is a film that is anchored by women in prominent roles, and one of them, Viola Davis, is a black woman.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about her.
We got to start thinking like professionals. We're in business together. There's not going to be some cozy reunion. After this job, we're done. We have 3 days to look and move like a team of men. The best thing we have going for us is being who we are.
Why?
Because no one thinks we have the balls to pull this off.
It was very important for me to have a black, upper middle class leading black woman who has a roots in Chicago, who is of the city, but has done well and is sort of saying upwardly mobile. Because I see those women and they're never represented. And I wanted to create someone with Viola that was a part of the fabric of Chicago.
This is a story not only about these women, but it's also a story about politics and about political disenfranchisement and representation. When you are thinking about the stories about politics that you want to tell in this story with your co-writer Gillian Flynn, what's happening in the country and how do you want that reflected in the story about politics in this film?
One only has to go to Chicago, and I've been going to Chicago for 22 years. My first solo exhibition as an artist, was in Chicago at the Museum of Contemporary Art there. And also my partner went to the Democratic Convention when Bill Clinton was the president. So I say my first footprint in Chicago was art and politics. And how all these strands, policing, politics, corruption, the church, et cetera, how all of these sort of institutions of power crisscross, you know, backroom deals, that was so intriguing to sort of find out with Gillian. And actually, we spoke to all these people off record, criminals, you know, introduced to us by police, aldermen, clergymen, all of it.
Let me ask you about Robert Duvall's character. He plays an old guard politician. He rants a lot about immigrants. He's clearly some sort of kind of white nationalist. You're shaking your head. Not a nationalist? How would you describe him?
Well, I think he's just, you know, he's a man of his times. I'm not defending him or what he says or what he does or his actions, but, you know, he is a man of privilege and he wants to keep the status quo.
But he sees the world as kind of us against them.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I'm a horrible person. Absolutely. I'm nationalist, possibly, but you see this in your everyday. And they don't necessarily associate themselves with any sort of affiliation. They're just who they are, you know, bigots, to be quite frank.
Let me ask you this last question. Unlike 12 Years a Slave, this is an action film. I mean,
yes.
Obviously there's action in 12 Years a Slave, but here things are blowing up. There's car chases.
Blowing up. Yeah.
What was that like?
It was fantastic because it was thrilling to sort of, look, again, I wanted to sort of hold in suspense. I wanted the whole shebang of movies I love growing up in this sort of like 70s or like things like Godfather or Chinatown. It sort of integrated itself in the environment it was placed in. So Chicago, for me, was very important to look at. But also at the same time, looking at it, it's just a reflection of how we live, you know, in our everyday, in a Western, a heightened Western contemporary city. So yes, it might be about Chicago, but it is about all aspects of how we live in the West.
Steve, great to see you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Steve McQueen is the director and co-writer of Widows. It's in theaters now. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Love me, say you do.